Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What would you do to feel younger than your years, and just how much control do we have over the way our bodies change as we age? My guest today wasn't exactly unhappy to be a woman of a certain age. She enjoyed the perspective on life that most of us only achieve after several decades of life. But she didn't want to feel betrayed by her aging body, particularly in a culture that equates beauty, value, and relevance with youth. So she set out on a year-long quest to explore and experience the wide range of purported solutions to aging and learn for herself which ones might actually live up to the hype. The new book by journalist Lauren Kessler is called Counterclockwise: One Woman's Midlife Quest to Turn Back the Hands of Time. Lauren, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much. I'm delighted to be here.
So you tell us off the top that you have been lying about your age in one direction or the other since you were a teenager, because you've essentially wanted the privileges that come with the age that you wished to be at the time.
Absolutely. And I think that I have a teenage daughter who is currently lying about her age as well. There's a certain point where you want to be older because older is better. And then there's a certain point where you don't want to be older.
Mm-hmm. And it seems like the years when you don't want to be older last much longer than that early period in your life.
Yes, you're right about that.
Of course, chronological age, and you make this so clear in your book, is really just a shorthand description of something different. It stands for how we look and how we feel at any particular moment in our lives.
Well, chronological age is the years that you've been on Earth, mm-hmm. right? It's what your driver's license says, how old you are. Biological age is how old you really are. That's the age of your body. And what I have read, just a great deal of science behind this, says that probably about after age 40, people age so differently because of what they're doing or not doing to themselves that our biological ages get to be wildly different. Our chronological ages stay the same. So everybody who was born 45 years ago is 45. Mm-hmm. But some of those 45-year-olds are 30 inside, and some of them are 55 inside.
So why is it that our bodies get better and better and better until a certain point, and then things begin to work less well than they once did?
Well, so the latest thinking is that 30% of how we age and how quickly we age is genetically determined, and 70% is within our control. Hmm. So, body is not made to last forever. So that's, we are going to age, but how we age and how quickly we age is, 70% is within our control. So what we do, the good habits and the habits of mind and spirit as well as body, make a tremendous difference.
So spirit is a big deal here, and I think this is really fascinating. The idea of thinking young, not just sort of sitting in a chair and wishing that we were 21 again, but a positive attitude about aging can have a more powerful predictive effect of how long we live than even our physiological health.
It was startling to me when I read the research that you're talking about, and it's not just one study, it's many, many studies, that a person's attitude, and it's not looking at life through rose-colored glasses kind of attitude. It's realistic, but it's empowering. In other words, it's I believe I can do something to. I believe in I am the actor of my life, not the victim of my life. I make things happen. I enjoy change, even when it happens when I don't want it to happen. I see challenges. I'll take some calculated risks. It's that kind of attitude that keeps people young and vibrant and vital.
Okay, so the next question, which is maybe trickier, is, are we in control of those attitudes? Can we cause ourselves to think this way, or are we sort of wired by life or by neurons to think in a certain way or not?
Well, prior to doing this research, I would have said we're wired that way. You're born with a personality that way. And then I started reading a whole literature of that I'm just going to call learned optimism, the biology of hope. And, optimism can be a strategy. You can actually teach yourself to be optimistic. And I think that's odd. I mean, I'm not really. I'm consider myself to be a pretty realistic and skeptical person, and the skepticism I think comes through in the book. But it sure is powerful evidence that we can teach ourselves to open up to experience, as opposed to think of it as something, you know, negative that's thrown at us.
Well, there are a number of really interesting studies in the book, but the one that fascinated me was that they took a bunch of elderly men, right, and they sort of put them in a camp and said, like, it's the mid-50s. Can you explain what they did?
Yeah, this was a great experiment. And as you say, it was a bunch of elderly men in their 70s and 80s, and they were first tested, non-invasive tested for their health. So blood pressure, cholesterol panel, strength, flexibility, oxygen capacity, lung capacity, that kind of stuff. And then they were put for a week in essentially a closed environment. And in the environment, the media, the television, the radio, the newspapers, the magazines were all put in there to create an atmosphere of their youth. So they were in their 80s, but it was material from the 40s, 1940s, that is. And they were told to only speak in the present tense and to not reminisce, but to just talk about every day and to interact with this media of their young adulthood. And then they didn't eat anything differently, and they didn't do any exercise any differently, and then they were all tested with the same exact testing. And it was mind-blowing that a number of those, they're called biomarkers, the way that we think about how old our body is, that those men got younger.
So let's talk a little bit more about biomarkers, because there are a number of exams you can have done, analyses of your body. Talk about the range of tests out there that might be able to give you a handle on how old you are biologically.
Well, there are some pretty easy ones. Blood pressure is a pretty good indication, especially changes in blood pressure across time. Everybody gets cholesterol work done, and that is both of those together would give you a sense of the healthier arteries, and that's a very important thing to know. There's a test called VO2 max, which people do in gyms or at clinics, that tests your ability to use oxygen to create energy, and that's also a sign of youth. Those are pretty non-invasive. I had one significantly invasive test done that is a muscle biopsy. So I had an incision in my thigh, and then somebody kind of poked around to get a couple of pieces of muscle tissue to test to see what my mitochondria were doing inside the muscle. Mitochondria are these little energy-producing, kind of like engines in the cell that produce energy. And the more you have and the more efficient you are, the younger that tissue is, whether it's heart tissue or thigh muscle tissue or whatever. But you have to go someplace and, you know, get an incision. And people just don't do this who aren't either writing a book or, in some sort of other kind of test group.
Yeah, yeah. Is it as painful as it sounds?
Well, I mean, it's a scalpel that cuts your tissue, so it's not fun.
So what can you learn by looking at the state of your mitochondria, the state of your, these things called telomeres?
Yeah, that's another test. And I didn't mention telomeres because it's really not very invasive. It's a blood test. So anybody who's had a blood stick for cholesterol can have a telomere test. It is really the study of telomeres, which are these protective caps on the end of your chromosomes. The longer they are, the younger you are, I'll just say. And the shorter they are, the older you are. You actually have some control over the length of your telomeres. There's good telomere science. Somebody won a Nobel on telomere science. But the testing itself, the public testing, is not is in its infancy stage. So it's very expensive and not easy to figure out who knows what they're doing.
On the other hand, you can go all over the web, and there are a number of these real age questionnaires that you can fill out.
Yes, which I did, and it's pretty funny if you do this.
Are you shopping for the best result?
Exactly. Yeah. So you do one, and it tells you that you're 2 years younger than you know you are chronologically, and you think, I can do better than that. I'm going to find another test. Until you find a test that says you're 15 years younger, and then you really love that test.
Mm-hmm. Which, I mean, I suppose it can be encouraging. On the other hand, it would have to cause you to question the accuracy of these tests.
Oh, it absolutely does. And if you use it thinking that you're going to get accurate results, then you're foolish. Mm-hmm. But so the way that I think you can use it, and I would encourage people to do this online, is to really look at the questions that they're asking.
Yeah.
Because some of them are pretty interesting. You know, they're the common ones, like how many times do you exercise a week and that kind of stuff. But they also, they will also ask, where do you live? What's your occupation? And things that, and attitude kinds of questions. So it's not just, do you eat fried foods and sit and watch television kind of questions.
So in some of the questions might be clues as to what proactive steps we could take.
Exactly right. That's how I would use the online questionnaires, not to actually determine how old you are, but to look at some of the factors that go into determining biological age.
So how much of the anti-aging industry is a sham, and how much is based in medical science?
That is a very interesting question, and possibly, unanswerable in that, in the form that you asked it. So what I would just say is that there is real credible, there's a real credible science of aging, and there are some significant understandings and breakthroughs, especially in the last 10 to 15 years. There's good science there about what's happening inside the body, and theories about, I think, why we age is pretty complicated. So we're not going to come up with one reason why the body ages, but there are a number of compelling reasons. So on that side, I'm very encouraged by the amount of work that's being done. And then, as you say, there's the whole huckster side. There's the selling of this with products that either that run the range of don't work at all and are just sort of ridiculous, to have some science behind them. But if you look carefully at the science, which I did, you find that a lot of the times the science was done on mice or rats or done, in very, very controlled lab situations and not in any kind of situation that you would find yourself in.
So you can't extrapolate and expect the same result.
Right. And so it's hard because, you'll look at something on the web or in an infomercial and it'll say, five studies have shown this. And in fact, there have been five studies, but maybe not the studies that are actually convincing.
We're speaking with journalist Lauren Kessler. Her new book is called Counterclockwise, One Woman's Midlife Quest to Turn Back the Hands of Time. We'll resume the conversation in just a couple of minutes. You can get on the line to join us now. The number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering summer courses for adults in literature and languages, cultural history, and arts and design at the Dallas, Plano, and Taos, New Mexico campuses. Registration at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're spending this hour with journalist Lauren Kessler. Her new book is called Counterclockwise, One Woman's Midlife Quest to Turn Back the Hands of Time. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, Lauren, I'm generalizing here, but is it safe to say that any product, any ad that says no effort necessary is unlikely to be very effective?
Unlikely would be putting it mildly. Yeah. I think that first of all, there is no cure to aging other than death.
Yeah.
And so I don't think you want to buy a product that cures aging.
Mm-hmm.
And anything that requires no effort on your part. I mean, is there anything worthwhile in any realm of life that requires absolutely no effort on your part? I don't think so.
Too good to be true.
Yeah.
So you attended this conference on anti-aging and regenerative medicine in Las Vegas. Can you explain for us the difference between regenerative medicine and the standard healthcare protocol for people who are aging?
Well, here's this conference, which happens both in Las Vegas and in Orlando and internationally, is really interesting. It goes back to the question you previously asked about how much is good science and how much is hucksterism.
Mm-hmm.
And I think both of them are played big at this conference. So you can go to a number of really interesting dynamic presentations by PhD researchers at institutes and find out about aging, and then you can also walk the floor and look at booths where people are selling things that that don't do any good. So one of the things about this new era of regenerative medicine that I think is very, very positive and wonderful is the attitude. Or is the attitude against, oh, well, you know, you're 50 now, or you're 40 now, or you're 60 now, pick a number, and, you know, you're going to just start slowing down, and that's just what happens. And that kind of attitude, or wait until you have an illness, and then a doctor will help you. And so the best of anti-aging regenerative medicine says, no, don't wait until you have an illness. Think positively and proactively about keeping yourself as vital and energetic inside as you possibly can by living the best kind of lifestyle. So I guess you could say you're regenerating from the inside out. And that's, you know, the idea that medicine can be about wellness as opposed to illness is it's actually revolutionary, and it's good stuff.
So whether we're acting on it or not, it seems everyone has gotten the message that exercise is important for a healthful life at any age, but certainly for sort of hanging on to the function that you have had in youth into your later adulthood. What kinds of exercise did you investigate? What did you experiment with? And what did you learn?
Well, I kind of did everything. I'm trying to think if there was anything that I didn't do. one of the things that is good is that I actually enjoy physical exercise, so it wasn't an awful thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
But as anyone who has tried to figure out what is the best exercise knows, you know, you can read and somebody will say, oh, CrossFit is the best. No, it's hot yoga. No, it's Tabata. No, it's, you know, sort of fill in the blank, whatever the current exercise of the week or month is. And I did try all of them.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think that in general, the high intensity interval training, however you might choose to do that, is probably the best way to achieve cardiovascular fitness, meaning short bursts of intense activity followed by very short recovery time. And you can do that in a CrossFit class or in a Tabata class or in a by running or by hiking or by skiing or anything like that. So the exercise itself is not that important. It's the interval part of it. That said, the biggest thing I learned about exercise is that you can't do what I've been doing for the last 20 years.
Which is what?
Go to the gym and sweat and grunt for an hour and then think you've got it and do that, you know, and feel great because you've done it 5 or 6 days a week. And then go back home and sit and write or, you know, Facebook or whatever it is that we do.
Yeah, the sitting is toxic thing is relatively new, and yet it appears to be very, very important.
Yeah, it is relatively new, and it makes sense. And it's something that we can all actually work with. It's not like, oh, my goodness, now I'm going to have to be a farmer or something. I can't be on the radio anymore. I can't be a writer. But what I've done is, just after reading all this research, is, yes, I still go to the gym, and I still do all of that stuff, but I set my my smartphone to play, to actually, it whistles at me every hour. And every hour I get up and I do, you know, at least 3 or 4 minutes of something.
Mm-hmm.
Generally, I like will chase my cat around the house, or I will go, you know, I'll run outside and do something. I will just have some kind of activity. It doesn't even have to be, I don't measure my heart rate, but every hour I get up. And I think that the research shows that that is a very good idea. And of course, integrating, we all know you're supposed to integrate physical activity into your life, but many of us don't live that kind of life. We get in cars and we drive places. We don't walk places. And I am guilty of that myself. So I've just tried to enforce this every hour I get up and move.
All right, I want to talk about, we'll talk about food in just a minute, but speak about what happens to our bodies as the ratios change, even if we try to stay fit, of bone mass and muscle mass to body fat as many people age.
Yes. So the bone mass generally goes, I mean, everything you want to stay the same or go up goes down.
Right. So unless you work really hard.
But I do think that, yes, I mean, I think that we have enormous control over this. And that's one of those differences I was talking about between conventional medicine and anti-aging / regenerative medicine, mm-hmm. where a conventional doctor will say to you, well, you know, after age 45, the percentage of body fat in women goes up, or the muscle mass goes down X percent a year, as if this is a given, as mm-hmm. if this is, you know, the way it is. And it is the way it is if you don't take control over it. The anti-aging regenerative people will say, this could happen, and you're going to have to work to make it not happen. So you do not have to lose 1% of your muscle mass every year, and you don't have to get fatter and fatter. I'm not talking about weight gain here. I'm just talking about the percentage of fat versus lean inside the body.
Yeah.
There's nothing that says that that has to happen other than us being increasingly sedentary.
And, you know, framing it that way sort of changes the whole calculus, doesn't it?
Well, it puts you in the driver's seat.
Yeah.
Well, it takes you out of the driver's seat.
it puts you on the track in your shoes, right. All right, so foods. You, of course, had to dip into the so-called superfoods. Talk a little bit about the things you ate during this phase of your investigation.
Well, I don't eat poorly generally, mm-hmm. but I've never made a concerted effort to do what I did for the book. So the first thing I did was a detox to you know, clean out my system from all of the Captain Crunch and other kinds of things that I've been eating. And then I researched the top 10 superfoods that were mentioned by very credible places like the Mayo Clinic or, you know, university nutrition sites and that kind of thing. And those 10, and there was a lot of unanimity, or there was unanimity about the 10, and they're not exotic. So they're, you know, then they're foods everybody knows, like salmon and broccoli and spinach and kiwi fruit and apples. And I think quinoa might be the most exotic one on there. And so for 1 week, I only ate those 10 foods. That was the only food I ate, except for the coffee that I drank, which was not on the list. but I won't talk about that.
Well, I mean, I guess there are conflicting studies about coffee, too. Some scientists seem to feel that it is pretty good for us.
Yeah, but it's not elevated to...
It's not a superfood.
...pantheon of superfood.
Right.
No. Mm-hmm. But, and then the next week, I increased that to 20, and it was the next 10, so it was 20 superfoods. And they're all, again, very normal foods that you find in the grocery store. Fruits and vegetables and, you know, black beans and that kind of stuff.
There are no red meats on the superfoods
list. There's
no
red meats. Mm-hmm. That's right. There's no red meats. And there's no fried things. Mm-hmm. And then for the third week, I investigated some of those exotic ones that we're constantly hearing about. Mm-hmm. You know, the ones that are grown only in the higher Andes of Peru under certain trees, and they cost $500 a pound.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I tried that stuff, and mostly I investigated it and found that these foods are not in any way bad for you. In fact, they are quite nutritious, but they're no more nutritious than the stuff that you can buy just off the grocery store shelf.
Which, again, is sort of comforting in its own way, because we don't have to, you know, go to the ends of the earth to eat properly.
It's true. And we don't have to believe, you know, there's a lot of money to be made selling people dried goji berries,
right,
for example. And I'm not trying to say that dried goji berries don't contain a lot of terrific antioxidants, but they don't contain any more antioxidants than, you know, strawberries or an orange. Well, somebody's going to call in and say, yes, they do. But, I mean, I'm just, they're really not, they're great, but they're not so great that you need to, you know, worry about it. The fourth week, I tried raw foods, but I don't know how many of your listeners have tried a raw foods diet. Before trying it, I thought that just meant eating salads and drinking fruit smoothies, which seemed pretty easy to me. But actually, raw food people, they try to make what I would call real food out of raw food. And it's very, very, very time consuming. It took me 3 days, not three full days, but parts of 3 days to make raw lasagna.
Hmm.
And it took my family about, three or four seconds to get it out in napkins.
To reject it, right?
And get on the phone and order pizza.
And I guess the thought there among raw foodists is that you are losing too many nutrients when you cook a lot of foods.
Yes, that's one of the thoughts. And scientifically, it makes no sense. Because what they're saying is that when you cook a food, you destroy the enzymes in the food. And it is incontrovertible scientific evidence that your stomach acids destroy the same. I mean, your indigestion, those enzymes are in fact being converted in your body. So if you don't cook any food and you get all those enzymes, they're disappearing in your saliva, and then they're disappearing in the hydrochloric acid in your stomach.
So tell us about your experiments with HCG and what you ultimately concluded about that.
Well, this was, you know, one of those things where there were so many hormone things that I was just petrified about trying, even though I was supposed to be a fearless guinea pig.
Mm-hmm.
There is a limit to what you actually want to do to your body. And I had done quite a bit of research on bioidentical hormones and human growth hormone, and I just really wanted to stay away from them. HCG is a hormone that's produced in the female body when you're pregnant, not at any other time. And there's decent research that says that it changes you metabolically and causes you to not store fat, but use fat. Instead, you use the energy that was going to be stored as fat. The food was going to be stored as fat as energy.
Mm-hmm.
So I tried it because it seemed less harmful than
like
other things.
If your body had had it once before, then you'll be okay this time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And one of the parts of this is that you are on a very, very restricted diet. So you're going to lose weight, which a lot of people are doing this HCG regimen to lose weight, and I wasn't. Not that I couldn't lose weight, but that's not what I was doing it for. Mm-hmm. I was doing it because I thought it would change the fat lean
ratios
in my body, mm-hmm. and the weight loss was just significant and ridiculous. I think it was. I wrote in the book. I'm not going to remember, but it's like.
I thought you said 17 pounds?
17 yeah. pounds in 21 days, something mm-hmm. like that. And, of course, that's unsustainable, you can imagine.
Right.
But also, when I then put myself on one of those scales that measure water content, fat content, bone, that kind of thing, it's a bioimpedance scale. Mm-hmm. In fact, I had done to myself exactly the opposite of what I wanted to do.
Wow.
I had lost a lot of water. And I had lost 5 pounds of muscle, and that, or rather 3 pounds of muscle, and that, you know, it's really hard to gain muscle. So when I gained back all of those 17 pounds, which of course I did the second I stopped, much of that gain was fat and not muscle. So I did the opposite of what I wanted to do.
And your conclusion ultimately was that maybe HCG has a bit of a placebo effect, and that's why you felt like you didn't want to eat?
But, I mean, I think the placebo effect is huge mm-hmm. and important and not studied enough. And there really is this mind-body thing where if you think something is going to work, then it's not that your body can actually make it work. So, yeah, oddly, I was on this ridiculously restrictive diet, and I'm talking about 500 calories a day, mm-hmm. and after a day or two, I wasn't hungry.
My guest is journalist Lauren Kessler. We're talking about her new book. It's called Counterclockwise, One Woman's Midlife Quest to Turn Back the Hands of Time. We'll resume the conversation in a couple of minutes. You can join us on the phone at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering summer courses for adults in literature and languages, cultural history, and arts and design at the Dallas, Plano, and Taos, New Mexico campuses. Registration at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Journalist Lauren Kessler is with us this hour. Her new book is Counterclockwise, One Woman's Midlife Quest to Turn Back the Hands of Time. You can join us at 800-933-5372, which is where we find David on the line in Plano. Hi, David.
Hi. It's been a great show again.
Thank you.
I have a question. This kind of goes back to the raw food consumption category, but I have some friends who are really big advocates of juicing, and I've kind of been exposed to it a little bit, and my thought was always, well, gosh, it's such a large amount of vegetable matter being basically wasted to get, you know, a drink or to basically subsist off of essentially a liquid diet. And I was curious to know what the Gershon Project and a few other organizations really propagate this belief that it actually works, and I was curious to know what your guest experiences were with the juicing world.
Yeah, thanks for your call, David. What do you think, Lauren?
Well, you know, nutritionists always say don't drink your calories. So there's two ways to look at this. One is, you know, absolutely we want to be eating fruits and vegetables. That is, there's no doubt about that, although more vegetables probably than fruits because of the high sugar content in fruits. And it's certainly true that peels and, you know, and cores and that sort of stuff gets thrown away, except if you compost it in a garden, and mm-hmm. it doesn't. So I don't think that there's certainly nothing wrong with juicing at all, but I do think that eating whole foods in the, in, you know, how they come off the tree or how they come out of the earth is probably, better for all of the systems in our body. On the other hand, if you have a cup of juice and you're equaling, eight pieces of vegetables which you wouldn't eat otherwise, then juicing is good. But I'm for chewing. I like chewing a lot.
And you get the fiber and all the other benefits as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it takes longer, yeah. And you feel fuller, and you feel like you've actually eaten something.
We have an email here from Steve who says, one thing I've noticed with my 83-year-old mom is that she's reluctant to deal with situations she would handily have attacked in earlier years. For example, she won't even think about entering a car dealership without her son's help. She also has a mind-her-own-business attitude now so as not to be stressed by sibling kids and grandkids. I've cautioned her, says Steve, that as she cedes her mental fortitude abilities, she will lose them.
I think that's really interesting. Although I do think that everybody ought to be cautious about going into a car dealership,
just as a general precaution.
So I don't think we should get her to do that. But yeah, I think that the idea of that's what I was talking about with the thinking young, that you're not thinking I'm going to go out to go disco dancing or wear a bikini, but you're thinking I'm in control of my life, mm-hmm. and I'm going to make decisions for myself. And I'm interested and curious about the world around me. And that is a youthful way to think. And, to the extent that the person who wrote the email said, would his mother lose it if she didn't use it? I think that's probably right. I think you have to practice those things, practice being proactive, practice being optimistic, practice taking control, just the way you would practice a yoga move. So I would definitely encourage him to encourage her.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Stephanie on the line in Dallas. Hi, Stephanie.
Hello, how are you today?
Great, thank you. Go right ahead,
please. I was calling. I myself am only 31, but I've been in the service industry for 13 years. And what she's been talking about, with exercise and short bursts and what many people have said about, kind of having smaller meals throughout the day as opposed to very large meals.
Mm-hmm.
I've noticed in a lot of people that work in the service industry, restaurants and such, the older folks will joke that that's what keeps them young. And so I was thinking that a lot of times it's like exercising, and with our short bursts at like lunchtime or dinner rushes. And so we have those short bursts of exercise, plus, most servers would probably say that they only have like one large meal a day and then get the rest of their calories as snacks throughout.
That's really interesting. What do you think about that, Lauren?
Well, I think that when your work integrates physical activity, If it's not physical activity where you're breathing in, say, pesticides, or you're doing something dangerous for yourself, or working with dangerous machinery, that is a healthy way to live. To have what you do for a living be physically active. I think that sometimes it can be so physically active in the restaurant industry that you maybe don't take care of yourself as well in your off hours as you possibly need to. The other thing the caller said that I think is really interesting is the one big meal a day thing. Mm-hmm. And I know that you didn't mean it this way because you said about the little snacks, which is good. But there's something that's been investigated and is now called the sumo wrestler's diet. And the idea is, how can you get people like sumo wrestlers to be that huge? How did they gain weight like that? Because they're like 400 pounds. But they're athletic. I mean, they train, and
yeah.
they have to. So people were thinking, oh, they must eat like 200,000 calories a day. Actually, they eat one meal a day, late in the day, and it's only about a 3,000 calorie meal. So it's what say a adult male might eat normally.
Mm-hmm.
They eat it once, and then they take a nap.
Huh.
That's it. So the rest of the time, their body thinks, I'm never going to eat again. And they store all, I mean, that's what happens when you only eat one meal a day.
So it's like a mini starvation cycle almost.
Mm-hmm. And the second that you take those calories, your body gets very stingy and says, okay, I'm going to put those calories, bank them right away in fat because I'm afraid we're not going to eat anymore. Who knows when we're going to eat? So if you want to gain weight, have one big meal.
Everybody, I'm sure, is writing this down as we speak. So I know it wasn't important to you necessarily. I mean, you weren't trying to sort of fake your way into looking younger. But, you know, you quote Oscar Wilde, who said, a man's face is his autobiography. A woman's face is her work of fiction. I mean, it does play into how we feel about ourselves when we look in the mirror.
That's absolutely true. But what I wanted not to happen, and what I see happening, is people who think that they can spend X number of dollars and put basically a mask on what their biological age is.
Yeah.
So if inside you have clogged arteries and a weak heart and honeycombed bones, and you spend $10,000 to get a lovely facelift, and you look in the mirror and you look 35, but you are 75 inside. Hmm. That is not doing anybody other than your plastic surgeon any good.
You did actually ultimately opt for this sort of injectable product, right? Called Dysport, is that right?
It's Botox.
It's Botox, okay. Yeah. So did it make a difference in how you felt about yourself?
Well, let's put it this way. I probably wouldn't have done it if I didn't feel I should do something for the book.
For the book, uh-huh.
Did it make me feel different about myself? When I looked in the mirror, the results were subtle enough. I think we think of the Botox products or injectable products as... We see the bad results.
Saran wrap face, that kind
of
thing.
Yeah, and I didn't look that way at all. In fact, no, I didn't tell anybody in my family that I was doing this, and I came back from the doctor's office and nobody noticed.
Which is good and bad, I suppose, depending on how you want to spend your money.
But I think, you know, so I didn't see some huge change in the mirror. Mm-hmm. But I do think that... If you work simultaneously on what's going on inside, I really can't fault people who want to do something. I mean, I wear contacts. I don't wear glasses because I think contacts look better on me. People should use hearing aids if they need, you know, support that way. Many women color their hair. So we're constantly changing our appearance in ways that please us more. Or help us. And so I don't really have a tremendous objection to altering parts of your body through plastic surgery. The objection that I have is a person thinking that that makes them young.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next to Haywan in Plano. Hi, Haywan.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
The question I have is, me and my husband recently watched a PBS documentary program, Michael Mosley's Eat Fast and Live Longer. I wanted to ask if Lauren is familiar with it. What does she think about it? We thought it was fascinating. We're planning on trying it, but I wanted to see her opinion.
On fasting is what you're talking about.
Yes.
Yeah. What did you learn about that, Lauren?
So fasting as... how do I want to say this? As I just said before, when you do not give your body food, it thinks that you're starving it, which of course you are. So the next time you eat, it saves everything that it possibly can. It doesn't give it to you as energy. It stores it as fat, thinking that you're going to need it because you're going to starve it again.
Mm-hmm.
However, there's, you know, decent evidence that a fasting day in between regular healthy eating days is, can give your body just a bit of a jolt, can give your internal, systems somewhat of a rest from digestion and, that kind of stuff. So people who go on long fasts are probably doing damage to themselves. People who integrate a day of fasting a month or a day of fasting every couple of weeks might. I don't know that there's any science that says that that's bad for you, and there's some science that says that it's good for you.
And could there be on the horizon some kind of pill to replace the effects of the extreme calorie restriction, which has been proven, at least in animal studies, to extend a healthful lifespan?
Yeah, actually proven more. I mean, it's very disturbing that that the one thing that's actually been proven in human beings as very significantly turning back the biological clock is severe calorie restriction. Mm-hmm. And by severe, I mean cutting calories by about a third. And that's every day, like for the rest of your life. It's not a diet. It's the way that you eat. So, yeah, they're working on a pill that that hormonally and with your enzymes and your hormones and everything else biochemically that's happening inside your body when you do that, mm-hmm. will mimic that without you starving yourself. But to me, it's one of those too good to be true things.
Yeah,
I can't imagine that there will be such a pill and that will have no bad side effects. It just doesn't seem likely to me.
It seems like a bad idea for the average American in this day and age, too, when we so love to eat that the pill that gives us permission to overdo it seems like a really bad idea.
I agree with that. And I also think that, eating is more than feeding your body. Mm-hmm. It's culture, it's religion, it's science, mm-hmm. it's art, and it's pleasure. And it is one of the pleasures of life. And I think we need to think of it that way and not think of tinkering with it in these severe ways, like I'm only going to drink juice, or I'm going to fast, or I'm going to cut my calories, because then, you may live longer, or you may not live any longer, but it'll feel like you're living longer,
yeah.
as my husband said.
Do you feel younger now than when you started all this?
I do, yes.
Mm-hmm. So there's a lot you're sticking with.
There is. There's a lot that I'm sticking with. And when I say, you asked me if I feel younger, I would say that when I went back and did all of those tests that we started out the hour talking about,
mm-hmm.
blood pressure, cholesterol, mitochondria, VO2 max, when I went back after my year of experimenting and tested, I had all those things tested, many of them moved in the right direction, and some of them significantly so. So I not only felt more energetic and vital and healthy, but in fact, inside me I was.
The new book by journalist Lauren Kessler is called Counterclockwise, One Woman's Midlife Quest to Turn Back the Hands of Time. Lauren, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks so much, Chris. It was fun.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can learn more about the show, find out about upcoming programs, and download the podcast free at kera.org/think. Email comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.